Hello everyone and welcome to this promotional podcast entitled Biosimilar Insulin in Practice. This podcast series has been initiated and fully funded by Sanofi. The content has been reviewed and approved by the sponsoring company and speakers prior to the broadcast. Editorial support for this podcast was provided by OmniMed Communications. In this episode, we look at the evolving role of biosimilar insulins in the management of diabetes, but also think about generally what biosimilar insulins are, what biosimilar means, and what the implications are for the NHS. My name is Dr. Amar Patana. I'm National NHS Advisor for Sanofi UK and also a diabetes consultant. I'm pleased to say that I'm joined by two colleagues and friends, Dr. Patrick Holmes, a GP with specialist interest in diabetes from Darlington, and Dr. Shafi Kamaruddin, MBE, consultant physician and deputy medical director, County Durham and Darlington NHS Foundation Trust. Hello, both.
Hi, Ma.
Hi.
So I guess going straight into it, Shafi, what is a biosimilar? What is a biosimilar product exactly?
Well, biosimilar has been around for a long time, actually. In the diabetes world, I suppose we are still quite new with regards to the usage of biosimilar. So it's, in effect, it's a copy version of the, you know, original molecule, what we call the reference molecule. And the way it's been manufactured is similar to, you know, the parent molecule, albeit that there's subtle variation. But in effect, in terms of its functionality, efficacy, safety parameters, they are similar to the parent molecule. It's just the way it's being manufactured. It's completely different. In essence, it's just a cheaper way of producing the parent molecule, to put it simply.
Right, okay. And I think you've mentioned a key word there, but Patrick, is there a reason why, I guess, we should be interested in biosimilars in the setting of diabetes in general?
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose in simple terms, it's almost like a generic drug, but we're talking about biological molecules here. And there's only finite resources in the NHS. And particularly at this time when we've got integrated care systems, if we can make savings on our prescribing budget, then potentially that gives us an opportunity to reinvest that elsewhere in the prescribing budget or for that matter, wherever the system needs it. So I suppose that's the value of these biosimilars, and the challenge obviously perhaps is how to implement it, but the value is that cost effectiveness.
Now, can you explain a little bit more about that, Patrick or Shafi? Maybe, you know, when you say cost effectiveness or cost savings, practically what does that mean exactly? Or what?
So, it's a very similar product, almost identical, but it's similar rather than identical. But you're getting it at a discounted price. So that chunk of money you can save. So it's, 20% off, it's 25% off or whatever the discount is when you go shopping. That's what it is. It's like getting an own brand rather than the Kellogg's cornflakes, let's say. So that's what we're looking at here. But it's a real value because we spend a huge amount on insulins, for example, if we're talking about the world of diabetes and where biosimilars fit in.
Sorry, Patrick, just to add on to what you said, basically, I think it's worthwhile mentioning that I think once the parent molecule has come off patent, it creates an opportunity create a copy version of the parent molecule. That's where the cost effectiveness comes in, isn't it? And it's a much simpler, cheaper way to manufacture the parent molecule and in vast quantities as well.
I guess one of the things when we talk about cost and benefit, obviously, is that reinvestment and reimbursement, everything across those sides of things. But sometimes one of the worries, especially in the setting of diabetes, as you know, a lot of people with their insulins, they are very protective of a person with diabetes and being on their insulin. They want to keep on their insulin. I see that's a potential barrier. I don't know. What is your experience? Is that something with these biosimilars in terms of efficacy? Is there anything there, or are they fairly kind of similar?
So I think what I would say basically is that it is inevitable there'll be very subtle differences, Amar. However, in order for the biosimilar molecules to be produced at mass level, they need to be some form of quality control. And the assurance really would be that the efficacy, the, you know, safety element of it, and the post-marketing surveillance will be in place. So, I mean, just to emphasize the point that, you know, biosimilar has been around for a long, long time. You know, it's just in the diabetes world, it's fairly new. But when you say new, you know, we're talking about 5-6 years down the line. So we've got enough experience. I think the issue here is the inertia behind, you know, moving patients onto biosimilar, taking full advantage of the cost-benefit ratio. But I just want to reassure everyone that from a safety element, you know, in effect, you are looking at the same molecule, albeit there are minor variations in terms of the batch, you know, how it's been produced, subtle differences in the type of bacteria, you know, yeast that they utilized, they used to manufacture these molecules, and, you know, the conditions that how the what do you call biosimilar molecules are being made. So, but ultimately, you know, based on at least our experience in County Durham and Darlington, we've embraced fully the adoption of biosimilar. But I'm quite happy to share some of our experience. But, you know, we started our community diabetes program along with Patrick in 2015, and it was an opportunity for us to really work, you know, across boundaries, primary and secondary care. And we thought one of the opportunities was to look at how can we, you know, what you call look at savings whilst maintaining excellence in terms of using current therapies. And biosimilar was one of the great examples. At the time, we had two new basal biosimilar insulin, which with a huge cost difference. And we gradually moved on to the biosimilar molecules over a three-year period and slowly phased out the original parent molecule with significant, you know, almost to £500,000 just literally doing that. But I agree with you that there were initial barriers, and it was, you know, and what we really need to emphasize is there need to be some sort of leadership, someone to champion it. Doesn't matter whether it's primary care or secondary care. If you've got a good community diabetes setup already, you're working collaboratively right across the board. Someone just needs to champion it. So that's the first thing, taking stock of the fact that, do you know what a biosimilar is? And when is the best time to use it? Now, there was a position statement, I think, by Diabetes UK in 2019, elaborating on the adoption of biosimilar. And I think one of the anxieties, and Patrick probably would want to come here, is the fact that there was a lot of anxiety about mass switching. And using our personal experience, we felt that the right thing to do was to be open and honest with our patients. Why are we switching to biosimilar? They're in effect the same molecule, but the expense of, but at the expense of saving some cost where we can reinvest back into our diabetes services. I don't know, Patrick, based on your experience in Darlington, what are your thoughts on that?
I would agree. The barriers are there, aren't they? We know insulin, if not used appropriately, can be quite dangerous, leading to hospital admissions through hypoglycemia, etc. So it's important that, you know, we treat this with respect. And of course, you know, HCPs and people living with diabetes get used to their particular insulins, and, you know, we're all quite conservative, aren't we? We don't like change. And I think so it does require that leadership, you say, because it's a change worth doing, because we're talking about huge amounts of money which can be more efficiently used to deliver healthcare. So it's and I think the timing is right now, particularly if we look at, for example, type 1 diabetes. We've got lots of people with technology on their arms to constantly monitor. So I think that gives an extra level of reassurance. But certainly, I would agree with you. The sort of mass switching is not helpful, because it doesn't give you that opportunity to discuss why you're doing this and what's actually in it for the HCP, and what's in it for the person who's living with diabetes. Because I've said, with all this expensive technology, we've got to find that money from somewhere in our budget, don't we? So this is, in a sense, this is about partnership working, not only between primary and secondary care, but also with the people we're looking after as well.
I want to bring up that, actually, you mentioned it. So yes, it involves a lot of people, but a large part is the primary and secondary care interface, isn't it? Because this comes from both sides, the specialist and the people who actually do a lot of the work in a way in diabetes and generally. From a primary care perspective, Patrick, in such situations with we're looking at biosimilars, what do you need from secondary care?
Well, I think Shafi hit the nail on the head, first of all, which is about leadership. I think there's also about communication. It needs to be clear and concise about what we're trying to achieve. I when we've done the work, or I've seen the work being done, and there's been that leadership's been there. But also what we've done is focused, particularly in the early days, are those people who are also, whose diabetes isn't particularly, their glucose levels aren't particularly well under control. So they actually benefit from additional input. And as part of that is the if it's appropriate, the switching to a biosimilar. So it's just part of a package of care. And really those people who are very well controlled, they're not on our radar initially because the value there is a lot less and therefore the risks of harm of it going wrong. So so actually you could say it's an opportunity actually if you're looking to introduce biosimilars, because there is this focus on those with less good control. And certainly my experience, that little bit of effort you put in and contact you put in to the person living with diabetes actually is probably worth far more than any little tweaking of the drug. So it's an opportunity actually just to, as I said, part of that reinvestment of funds is in people and by diabetes specialist nurses to support primary care or if you have a diabetes model like we do, and I suppose increasingly around the country, I think we are looking at these integrated models. As long as a nurse or a doctor or a pharmacist is appropriately confident and trained in diabetes, then they can action these, be part of these switching programs as well. So it's I suppose one of the big anxieties has always been that. Traditionally, these products have been started in secondary care, and then it's over to us just to literally sign a prescription, and that's been all we've done. And I think that's certainly one of the big barriers, because you don't feel you're in control of that. As I said, certainly in Darlington, it's worked, and County Durham, it's worked really well, and I think that's partly because of the model we have and the close working which comes with it.
I suppose there's nothing different from your side, Shafi, as a secondary care, looking at primary care is very similar, or is anything else?
It's very similar. I think the anxiety stems from the risk of hypoglycemia. And obviously when biosimilar came out, the notion was to do what we call a one-to-one switching. So that's where the anxiety comes about, because historically, when you think about insulin, when we swap over, this is out with a biosimilar, there was always this notion of 10-20% reduction, particularly in type 1 population, so that we can safely convert patients from one insulin to the other. But I would agree with Patrick that we took the opportunity to focus on our patients who were, poorly controlled. We had a threshold. We set it at 69 millimoles per mole. Those were the patients where we were trying to engage with, one, to improve their control, but there was also an opportunity to have a discussion with them about swapping over from an analog to a human or to a biosimilar insulin at the time. And it's been greatly successful. You'll be very surprised when you are very open with your patients about cost-saving measures. They'll be your advocate as well. And absolutely working alongside our GP colleagues, who've got a special interest in diabetes, our nurse practitioners. And Patrick is absolutely right that typically in secondary care, we are the one who initiates these switchover or startup of new insulin, biosimilar insulin. But I think we need to move away from that. We need to really have a really good working relationship with our primary care colleagues, because from what I've learned, at least in our patch, actually most of the insulin are started by our primary care colleagues. And if we can work together, focus on excellence such as starting biosimilar insulin while we can reinvest in terms of the savings that we make, I think it's a win-win situation. Yeah, I definitely it's the way forward for me. What we did was we broke it down for type 1 and type 2. I mean, a large proportion of our type 2, we've got about 40,000 patients with diabetes in our patch. And of which, if you give and take, 10% would be type 1, 4,000. So really, the market is type 2. We focused on that first. And then Once we build up our experience, then we moved on to our type 1 population. But again, setting a slightly higher threshold of a high HbA1c, being cognizant of the fact that there's variability, risk of hypo. And very quickly, as we build up our experience, we were very comfortable switching over. So for now, we don't even think about it. We prescribe biosimilars both for our basal and, you know, for our new, many new quick-acting biosimilars coming into the market. Huge advantage for the health economy.
And certainly from a primary care perspective, I do start people on insulin. And it's a long time since I started some of these branded ones, the ones where we do have a biosimilar equivalent, because you don't want to be starting someone on a product which you know is only going to be changed in the future. You might as well start as you mean to go along. And so that's another step change in terms of those new people coming on to either insulin or where it's appropriate, they're going to be on to a basal or some of the more rapid acting insulin analogs too.
Thank you both. I think we're coming towards the end. I want you to just think about one point you want to tell our listeners, just to say kind of either, you know, about knowledge or moving forward, what to do with the setting of biosimilars. It could be anything you could think of that you think would be relevant. I just want to highlight to everyone listening that it's the Diabetes UK 2019 statement that's talking about biosimilars that you might want to have a look at, which is what we've been mentioning about earlier. So you had your time. Shafi, what was one thing you might want to just tell us as we end, just about biosimilars?
I think from a secondary care point, if you work with your primary care colleagues, bring your patient along, they'll be advocate for switch over to biosimilar.
Excellent. And Patrick?
Reinvest the money in the people who are doing the work. So make sure the workforce is supported in this. Nobody likes being done to.
Thank you both. And thank you everyone for listening. On that note, I think we'll end that here. I think it's been a very informative podcast. I'd like to thank my guests. We hope you found the discussion of interest for yourselves and for your clinical practice. Don't forget to look out for our next episodes and also our previous episodes in this podcast series. And if you'd like any further information and access to this information on diabetes-related resources, please visit www.sanofidiabetes.co.uk. Thank you and take care.